For those concerned about the Trump presidency, comedy has become a form of therapy as you take your seat in the couch after a crazy news day and let it all out with Dr. Colbert or Dr. Kimmel. But the joke is on us. That's the title of Illinois State University professor Julie Weber's new book and about the state of political comedy. She says now is an especially good time to examine political comedy as subversive comics deliver their punchlines on platforms that are owned by the most powerful corporations on earth.
I think it's interesting now. It's been interesting for, gosh, close to 20 years almost. But especially now, because I think another thing that's happening is that people are starting to become more aware of what's happening with income inequality and what's happening with politics and the relationship between politics and income inequality. And so the question becomes, you know, what has political comedy been doing to make us aware or to motivate us to think about what's happening in politics and the economy more critically? And political comedy, I argue in the book, has not really done that. And there are a lot of reasons for that.
Yeah. And so you and your contributors in this book, The Joke is on Us, look at political comedy through this lens of neoliberalism. Can you explain neoliberalism and, you know, let's pretend we're all college freshmen here since you are an educator here at Illinois State?
It's an unfortunate term. It's been around for a long time. Nerds like me debate it all the time. But I like it simple in the sense that most people agree that, and I think anyone would agree, what we've been doing with our economy in the United States and elsewhere in the developed world and everywhere else in the world, really, is letting the market decide, make most of our decisions for us. So we've said states are going to back out of the way, politicians are going to back out of the way, and they're going to allow multinational corporations and workplaces and employers, even small business employers, to make the decisions about how best to maximize their bottom line. And that will provide for all of us, right? This old story about the rising tide that lifts all boats. That's neoliberalism, right? Just trying to reduce any of those, what they'd call state interferences or people interferences in the workings of the economy.
So I started looking at your book with a chapter about late night shows by Don Weissenin, a professor who's based in New York. So how would you describe the role that today's late night hosts play in our culture in this kind of Trumpian moment?
I was really happy that Don proposed this chapter when I put the volume together, because I thought we needed something on just a sort of general chapter that went over the kind of politics. And Don himself is a comic, too, so he knows how this works. The politics of being a comedian, right? What happens in that industry behind the scenes? The bottom lines and the focus groups and these kinds of things that go on. I think we assume that political comedy and late night TV is always going to be edgy and critical. But one thing that Don's essay reminds us of, I think, is that it's really determined by the bottom line and by what corporations are willing to let comics present and what audiences feel comfortable hearing. So I think that late night political comedy has played a largely therapeutic role, comforting people right after a long day of work. And it's not too edgy in the sense of motivating them politically or socially to think critically about their everyday lives.
And that connects back to your larger point about neoliberalism. And these are giant publicly traded companies that just happen to have late night hosts who are coming off as subversive in some way. But, I mean, Don is sort of connecting that back to that bottom line that you were talking about.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's important to realize, because even in my own discipline, there's been this kind of small critical work, version of critical work that looks at whether or not late night shows stimulate people to vote more or participate more in politics. And I just always thought that was a misleading question, simply because if you looked at the industry and background of it, it was never going to be that radical to begin with.
Brian Stelter from CNN, he's their kind of media critic, media reporter, wrote an interesting piece on what he dubbed the Stephen Colbert primary, about how all of these Democratic presidential candidates for 2020 were coming on his show to kind of kiss the ring a bit. I mean, we've seen it with Bernie Sanders, Kirsten Gillibrand, and the list goes on. I guess, what do you make of that intersection of late night comedy and, you know, legitimate Democratic presidential primary politics.
It's interesting that you say that, because now you're reminding me that it seems like Colbert has been, you know, even from his beginning of his first show on Comedy Central in 2005, he's always had a slight edge. You know, he's managed to kind of buck industry a little bit with his comedy. And I think it's his delivery, his specific delivery, the way his irony and the way that he does comedy is very, and that goes all the way back to his early stuff on Strangers with Candy, which is brilliant. But I think that he's like the new Meet the Press in a way, right? Meet the Press, which was always what we called in the era of broadcast news, you know, where you had one person at seven delivering the news and everybody was on the same page about what the news was and what reality was. Now you have all these different markets for news that people can go and get what they want to hear. So, but he's more like, and you had Meet the Press on Sunday, where whenever there was some kind of controversy, everyone would show up and sort of give their opinion about what was happening. But it's interesting that now political comedy is becoming this sort of delivery vehicle for a kind of what's happening in American politics and what's the standard bearer. He's become the new standard bearer.
And even the world leaders that Trump has been fighting with seem alarmed by how little he understands trade. EU chief Jean-Claude Juncker reportedly met Trump armed with a series of colorful, simple flashcards to explain the trade war. And the word that really gets me there is colourful, because that means that they had some simple flashcards and thought, no, too wonky, let's get some big fun baby colours on those things, let's give him a chance.
And John Oliver, the host of HBO's Last Week Tonight, he comes up repeatedly in the book, The Joke Is On Us, that you edited. You know, HBO is still a big company owned by another big company. It's probably owned by another big company. But I don't know, John Oliver seems like a bit of an outlier here, an interesting outlier. What's your take on his place in this world of political comedy?
Well, I would urge everyone to check the book out at the library and read the three chapters on it. But aside from that, which are very good, but I think that he does, it's like a sort of 60 Minutes format. Because he's able to do that longer on HBO, so he can get into topics and really explain them to people and look at his, you know, the background, short histories of issues. In that sense, it's really informative. Another great thing I like about John Oliver is that HBO made it free on the web so that college students can see it. It's very popular with college students and young people, so who don't have a lot of money. So it's very much a millennial show. And I think that was a really smart move. So the format and the access were two really important things about Oliver. But you know, just like any, I think any corporate sponsored, you know, political comedian, he has his limitations too. And I think, you know, he's been rightly criticized for some of his shows on, for example, Venezuela and others. So he gets it right and he gets it wrong, but I think he tries. And I think he's got a really popular audience in millennials, and that's important.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Illinois State University Professor of Politics and Government, Julie Weber, who edited the new book, The Joke Is On Us, about political comedy. So in your conclusion to the book that you wrote personally, you spent a lot of time on this Cartoon Network Adult Swim show called Million Dollar Extreme World Peace.
Because hate is whack, dude.
My race is done. You're inheriting the earth, along with some other undesirables. And that's cool, bro. High five. But check it out. Just remember who built this place, all right? Remember to pay homage to the white man.
Short-lived, but it's sort of important to this discussion that you're raising. So for our listeners, what is Million Dollar Extreme, and who is Sam Hyde?
Million Dollar Extreme was a very short-lived web show, and it's unclear whether it was as popular as he said it was or as unpopular as the network said it was. But they canceled the show right after the election of Donald Trump in 2016. And Sam Hyde, who was the... It's still unclear if he's a comedian or not. He's kind of in the vein of Andy Kaufman. So, you know, you're not sure if he's serious or not, saying these kind of, you know, politically incorrect things, doing politically incorrect skits. You know, Andy Kaufman did that thing where he wrestled a woman. And that was very controversial. So Hyde was canceled, and there was some kind of brouhaha that that network executives were very angry because they thought he was a Trump supporter, and he felt like he was fired and his show was canceled because he was a Trump supporter. It's still not clear whether he was or not, but he became pretty popular with what we now, you know, call alt-right kind of audiences, largely composed of very ultra-conservative sort of young men who were kind of angry about the direction of the country, especially the Republican Party's role in it, and more supportive of Donald Trump.
I remember the Washington Post did a big piece about this show and its cancellation and called it like the first victim of this perceived Trump-era culture war. So for you, as you're writing the conclusion to this book and trying to wrap up the kind of your thesis here, why was it such an important show for you in this discussion?
Well, it was important because it kind of encapsulated like this idea that everyone sees themselves as a victim in a weird way. Those on the right, those in the corporate Democratic sphere, right? And none of them are victims, really, which I found kind of interesting when I was looking at it, right? And it was a big controversy about which would you rather see. And for me, I think, you know, I would have rather had, you know, no one in charge, none of those folks in charge of what kind of comedy we could consume or listen to. I'd be more interested in being focused on something like workplace comedy, which I think The Office was kind of a trailblazer in that sense. It didn't go far enough, but it was very good at showing how we don't question corporate and managerial policy, right? And the relevance of it to our lives.
Well, Roseanne sort of enters the conversation here, too. The revival of her show on ABC last year is pretty well documented, as well as its undoing.
The autopsy found that it wasn't a heart attack. Roseanne OD'd on opioids.
Her character was a Trump voter, not exactly like a common occurrence on network TV these days. But she got fired after making a racist remark about Valerie Jarrett on Twitter. Show continued without her. It's now called The Conners, with John Goodman kind of leading it up. What do you think about the show Roseanne and its current form, and what that show says about this moment in political comedy and culture?
It's sort of sad, actually, because I think the original Roseanne was so great in the sense that there were very few working class people on television and in media. And I had a colleague who's no longer with us named Pepe Leistina, who did a documentary film called, I think it was Class Dismissed, where he talked about how we no longer talk about class issues in popular culture. And so there's really no representation. I mean, even at its worst, you know, at least Archie Bunker, there was some working class politics there. And Roseanne was like that. And Roseanne Barr, the comedian, was a central part of writing that story. And so she was very talented. The writers on that show were very talented, and it was a good show. But this new kind of Roseanne demonstrates sort of what happens when, you know, this corporate managerialism takes over the numbers, the focus groups, giving audiences what they want, which may not always be what's accurate in terms of representation. So I think it's kind of sad. I don't really want to remark on what happened with Roseanne and her personal issues, but I think that the show had real promise if it, you know, made a turn at some point in terms of looking at those workplace issues again and class issues again in a more critical light. Because it is there's a real lack of attention to these issues and the focus on the workplace, I think.
So what do you hope that we, as consumers of comedy, take away from this book? How can we adjust our own lens to be to pick up on more of what's happening in the kind of the realm of political comedy?
I would look at what's being covered in political comedy in terms of, like, content. You know, are comedians talking about things that most Americans deal with every day that are absurd, like in their workplaces, which is where most people spend most of their time? Or is it really about, which I think a lot of comedy is focused on individual faults and defects? Are the faults and defects of groups? Men are this, women are that, right? That's always a standard setup in a comedian script that reinforce these kind of tired old stereotypes. But they do get the audience on the page sometimes for the comedian to do something more radical. So I would say, looking at the content of it, is it more focused on how people can live their lives in a more free way? Or is it focused on how people can stay sort of within the kind of leash of consumer capitalism, which I think is what a lot of comedy does. It makes jokes about our consumer habits. It makes jokes about these things. But in the end, it's kind of like, yeah, but that's who we are and that's what we do. But I don't think that's all we are and what we do. I think we have a much broader range as humans, and that's not always represented in political comedy.
And that's Illinois State University professor of politics and government, Julie Weber, who edited the new book, The Joke Is on Us, about political comedy.